This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The cities of Gary and Michigan City are participating, along with 11 other communities here in Indiana, as part of the Indiana University's first resilience cohort. It's a way to take a look at the issue of greenhouse gas emissions in communities and local governments as well, and how to deal with them. And we have with us to talk more about the project over the state and a little more details about what's happening in our communities, Janet McCabe. She's the Assistant Director of the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute. Pardon me, it's based in the Bloomington campus, and she works out of IUPUI. As well. Janet, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Chris.
Tell us a little bit about the importance of being able to do a greenhouse gas inventory and really how Hoosier cities and towns and counties really need to keep track of that.
Well, this is a really exciting opportunity for Hoosier local governments. We know from a lot of research that's being done here and elsewhere that our climate is changing and that we need to get a handle on the greenhouse gases that are being emitted that are helping to cook the planet. And so this program allows these cities to inventory, basically to get an understanding of what greenhouse gases are being emitted in their cities, in their communities, and also, if they wish, within state government itself. And if you know the old saying, you can't manage what you don't measure, until we have a sense of where the greenhouse gases are coming from, it's really hard to design programs that will help us reduce and mitigate those emissions.
I know we take a look at the greenhouse gas emissions on the global basis, or whether we talk about beyond just the community basis here, but there is something that we should know about, I guess. As you mentioned, the inventory is going to help keep track of, because there are problems that happen here at home, not only with climate change and other things too, that do come down to not knowing where the greenhouse gases are coming out and the impact that they're having, aren't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, there are just so many things to know about keeping track of this. So one thing we do know is that every ton of additional carbon that goes into the atmosphere is going to increase the effects that global warming and climate change is going to have on our communities. And that means hotter temperatures. It means more rain when we don't need it and less rain when we do need it. And just as an interesting little statistic, in Lake County, if now people are used to having just a couple of days a year, really, really hot days, like over 95 degrees, by the middle of the century, Lake County can expect to have a month's worth of days over 95 degrees. So just think about the impacts that will have on people in their daily lives. Do they have air conditioning or do they not have air conditioning? How much time do they spend outside? What does it mean for landscaping? What does it mean for infrastructure? All these sorts of things what does it mean for mosquitoes and allergens and that sort of thing? So this, we're talking about real impacts on people's communities. So we want to do the best we can to reduce those emissions. But there are other advantages too, because if a mayor finds out through doing this inventory that he or she is spending a lot on old, perhaps energy inefficient heating and cooling systems, which are one of our biggest sources of greenhouse gas emissions, that mayor would then have some support to look at designing a program to upgrade, invest in more energy efficiency, which not only reduces greenhouse gases, it reduces other air pollution, and it also saves the taxpayer money. It's just, win-win all around.
Now, taking a look at our communities here in Gary and Michigan City in particular, how do they get involved in getting on the list, so to speak, so that they're one of the communities that are getting involved in this first resilience cohort?
Yeah, good question. And I want to give a shout out to both of those communities for stepping up for this first opportunity. So the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute, which you mentioned, which is one of the university's grand challenge initiatives, is supported working with our IU Sustainability Office, supported by the McKinney Family Foundation, to provide a summer intern to each of a bunch of cities who want to do this. This is the first time that we're doing this. It's basically no cost to the cities. They get a trained intern from IU, either an undergrad or a graduate student, to spend 10 weeks working on this. And we at the Institute worked out a relationship with an organization that provides software and training for cities that want to do these inventories. So there's a very well-developed protocol that people can learn how to do to collect the information that you need and put it in the right format. So we've got 13 cities all across the state, all the way from Evansville in the south to Gary and Michigan City and Goshen in the north, big cities, small cities. We have Oldenburg, Indiana, which has 600 people and is the smallest city ever to do one of these inventories. So we knew that Michigan City and Gary were both cities that are being very proactive when it comes to sustainability and resilience work. And when we put out the solicitation, anybody want to do this, they stepped right up right away.
And we know that Brenda Scott Henry is involved with the City of Gary's Green Urbanism Department, and I'm not surprised that she would be the first on the list to be sure that the City of Gary got a chance to get some help in looking into the issues of greenhouse gas emissions. When it comes down to actually measuring around the community to see where these gases seem to be collecting, at least where the spots that seem to be the most prevalent for these, is it something similar than what the Indiana Department of Environmental Management certainly has done for years up here in the region and in dealing with the pollution problems?
Well, it's not unrelated. So the Department of Environmental Management has programs that collect pollution information from industry, from large industrial operations in Lake County, actually all across the state. And those sources, like the steel mills and the power plants and the refineries and all, have to report their emissions of air pollution. There's no requirement in the same way for reporting emissions of greenhouse gases. There is a little bit, actually, but not at the level that would give you a sense of what's happening in the community. So a lot of our greenhouse gas emissions come from our use of power and heating and cooling and electricity needs. A lot of it comes from transportation. So it's about a third comes from power use, about a third comes from transportation. And the way you get a sense of emissions coming from transportation is kind of what NDOT does, working with the Department of Environmental Management to look at the vehicle fleet and the miles traveled and make some estimates about where those emissions are coming from.
Now, what's the communities, Gary and Michigan City and Goshen, as you mentioned, and the others that are involved in the resilience cohort this summer or get their information turned in, what happens to it from that point on? You folks at the Institute take it from there, and in turn we'll get back to the communities that are involved in this and get them more information to get them directed in the right direction, getting the right equipment, getting the right vehicles on the road to keep the pollution down?
Well, that's a great question, because you collect this information, then you don't want it to just sit there. So Michigan City and Gary, as we've already said, are very proactive cities. So I know that they will be eager to have this information so that they can then start putting together a plan, a resilience plan. The city of South Bend is a little bit ahead of these cities because they've already done this inventory, so they're now in the process of developing a plan that will include specific actions that will be prioritized based on the information that they collected. The Institute where I work and the Grand Challenge is already providing resources to cities and towns. Even if you aren't doing this inventory project or you haven't gotten the results yet, it's not too soon to be looking at, well, maybe we should be investing in electric vehicles in our community or electric vehicle charging infrastructure so that our residents who have electric cars will have places to charge them. Maybe we should be looking into solar energy or buying wind energy. Maybe we should be looking at some kind of an energy audit. And so through the Institute and through our website, we have lots and lots of information for cities and towns already and are eager to help anybody that would want to reach out. In particular, we have a tool called the Environmental Resilience Institute Toolkit, or ERIT, where we have lots of information, resources specifically for cities and towns, although anybody can use it. And people can go on there, and if they're interested in what is going on with climate change and indoor air quality or climate change and wetlands or water quality, they can look that up, and we have examples, case studies from what other cities, especially around the Midwest, have done to try to become more resilient around those issues. And, you know, we understand at IU that mayors and county commissioners and such in Indiana are need this information, but it's not super helpful to have the examples be cities like Miami or New York City, which are huge, and also on the coast, and so they're dealing with coastal issues. We're dealing with Midwestern issues. We're dealing with flooding and hot temperatures and what's going to happen to our agricultural economy and what's happening to our tree species and that sort of thing. And also, we have a lot of small to mid-sized cities who can't do the kinds of things that Chicago can do, or even Indianapolis. So they need examples from smaller cities, from comparable cities around the Midwest. And that's what we try to do at the Environmental Resilience Institute.
And we know the cohort has just gotten underway with their real work. They had the folks from campus help out starting this month, and it's going to continue on, I guess, it went until September. And by that time, you hope to have enough information together to be able to turn back over to the communities to give them the guidance for what they need to do?
Yep. Well, that's our hope. In fact, Gary, I think, is having their kickoff meeting this afternoon. So they'll be working all over the summer while the students are available, and we're confident that that's enough time to pull this information together. And then we'll want to work with each of these cities to see what it is they want to do next. This is very much driven by what the cities themselves want to do and what their leadership wants to do and what the communities want to do. There's so many positive things that can happen in communities as a result of these kinds of activities. Now, I think a lot of times people get sort of overwhelmed by the notion of climate change because it seems like such a huge problem, and if I recycle my one Coke can, is that really going to make much difference? What can I do that can make a difference? And it's easy to feel that way, but it's really important that we understand that there are so many positive things that we can do, and they're good things to look forward to, not just doom and gloom.
I know it's very easy to get scared about these things, especially when we note, like you mentioned, the fact that we're going to have hotter than usual summers. That's just going to be the case. We're going to have much more rain. We've already complained about having too much rain already and dealing with the problems in the communities with flooding and the like. And they see it on the Kankakee River and the Yellow River now because we've had all this rainfall, more than what we usually expect in the spring. And we're just probably going to panic about that in the months ahead, too, won't we, if we don't have the right data to be able to go into it right.
That's right. And, of course, data is power, right? When you have data, then you can understand things better, and then they're not as scary. And this is about our kids. This is making sure that when our kids and grandkids grow up, they have an Indiana that's as wonderful to live in as we've had, and or even more wonderful, and not be afraid that the kinds of things that we can do to ensure that kind of a future will be good for us today. Will make our homes more comfortable, will make it cheaper for us to heat and cool our homes and get around town, will make healthier communities, more sidewalks, more green space. That's all good for air pollution, which, of course, is a concern in Gary and Northwest Indiana more than a lot of other parts of the state. Let's clean up the air and clean up the water and provide better quality of living for everybody now, and that will help us in the future.
Now, as we go through the summer months and the data is collected and gathered and sent on to the Institute later, what's likely to be the place where people can find out how things have turned out in their communities or around the state of Indiana, and how Environmental Resilience Institute rather is going to be able to put all this together into a report? Where can you find out later a little bit more?
Well, actually, the cities who are doing these inventories, they own this data. This is their project and their information. So I expect that the cities will be deciding how they're going to make the information available to people in the way that makes most sense to them. And the Environmental Resilience Institute will work with them to help them do that, and then work with them to think about what next steps might be.
Jan McCabe is the Assistant Director of the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute. The Institute is working with the cities of Gary and Chicago and Michigan City and a number of others here around Indiana during the summer months collecting this data about greenhouse gas emissions to be able to put together what is being now IU's very first resilience cohort. And we'll find out later in the year, no doubt, from the cities as to how they're going to be able to put all this data that they gather to good use. And Janet, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this, about the work that IU's School of Environmental and Public Affairs is doing in this through the Institute, and how we can find out a little bit more and ways to keep the environment safer.
Well, thanks so much for having me and for your interest in the topic.
You're welcome. And this is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Nationwide, e-cigarette use rose an alarming 78% among high school students last year. The Food and Drug Administration's warned manufacturers to stop marketing to kids by using fruity flavors and colorful packages. But that hasn't stopped the surge, even in rural areas where the access to stores is limited. Lita Noon reports from a school in Newton County.
North Newton Junior Senior High lies in the northwest corner of Indiana, in a county home to more dairy cows than people. But students have no problem getting e-cigarettes in all shapes and sizes. Some look like pens, others like computer thumb drives.
Probably most people my age, if you're not a smoker or none of that, it could be sitting right in front of you and you wouldn't even know what it was.
That's teacher Bob Gonzi, who took an informal poll of PE students. Junior high kids estimate 65% of their classmates are using vape devices, and high school students think their numbers are even higher. Assistant Principal Jerry Taylor dumps a bag full of confiscated materials onto a desk. There are vape pens, a bottle of marshmallow-flavored e-liquid, an electronic charger, and the highly popular Juul brand devices.
There's been 34 vaping episodes, and we put kids out 3 days.
Taylor explains that without a specific vape policy, they're following the 3-day suspensions of the smoking policy. Because e-cigarettes are so easy to hide, they're very disruptive in classrooms. Health teacher Josh Stringfellow says students blow smoke rings while the teacher is turned away.
They'll film it on Snapchat, send it around the school because, hey, I got away with it in so-and-so's class. I did this trick in this teacher's classroom. And now they're one-upping each other. And that's why they're being caught more easily, is because they're being so blatant about it.
A senior from nearby Lowell High School, Kate Holdeman, says vaping became the hot thing after winter break last year.
It's pretty crazy. It's definitely an epidemic. I mean, for a long time, you like couldn't walk into a restroom without like vapor just being in your face because everybody at some point did it.
Holdeman says he doesn't use e-cigarettes, but his friends do, and his mom, Stacy Stewart, says that's worrisome.
My smart kid over here started hanging out with some not-smart kids who did stuff like that, and, I mean, it was in his car a lot, and we had a blow-up about it. I mean, it's better now, but it's just scary because there's so many health things that kids just don't realize.
And those health consequences are real. Newton County Public Health Nurse Kim Durham says the problem, nicotine.
What we're really still looking at, once again, are people having a nicotine addiction. This is the kind of stuff that leads to heart disease later, that leads to cardiovascular problems, that can lead to pulmonary problems. There's all kinds of different things that can go into play here.
She spoke to 6th and 8th graders at school health fairs.
I was actually mostly surprised because we asked them where they started doing it, and a lot of them said, well, my parents do it. And some of them had, that's kind of how they ended up getting introduced to it, was mom and dad.
Durham says there's a misconception e-cigarettes are safe because some people use them to stop smoking. But she says nicotine levels can be much higher in e-cigarettes. North Newton administrators want to curb the use of e-cigarettes next year. Taylor says they're considering having the local police get involved.
Start ticketing these kids if it's $150 or whatever, and maybe that would curtail them buying these vapes and bringing them into school.
Gonzi agrees that that will make a difference.
You know, we find out here, hold the parents responsible. You get in their pocketbook a little bit, they'll curb behaviors, especially for their children.
For next fall, Gonzi and Taylor are working toward a school e-cigarette policy. They also want to develop information for the curriculum and for parents. Meanwhile, they'll get some help from the FDA. New ads about the dangers of e-cigarettes are scheduled to hit the airwaves this summer. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Lee Dinoon.
And we go from e-cigarettes to EMTs, or emergency medical technicians. Franciscan Health EMS Academy is a new partner in helping get students the opportunity to be able to get their certification to become emergency medical technicians. There are two locations that are set up this year. One's in Crown Point at the Franciscan Health EMS Academy, and also in Valparaiso. Let's check in now with the Academy's director, Rob Dowling, to find out the changes and the partnership that the Mac Foundation is joining in. And Rob, thanks for being with us today on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, for folks that are not familiar with what the Franciscan Health EMS Academy is all about, tell us what you folks do and the training that you offer up to students so they get to become full-fledged EMTs.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Primarily what we do is we provide two emergency medical technician courses per year. In addition to that, we provide one paramedic course per year. Now, in order to qualify to become a paramedic, an individual needs to serve as an EMT or emergency medical technician for a period of about 6 months. And the benefit to that is that the student or the candidate, for that matter, then has enough experience that would then make them better prepared to enter the paramedic program. Now, as far as the emergency medical technician program goes, this year what we've done is we've actually doubled the number of courses that we provide to include a course at the Highland Fire Department. They've been nice enough to welcome us there. And the MAC this year, which we are extraordinarily excited to be able to partner with them. Because as many of you may know, they also have a firefighter training academy. So with the addition of the emergency medical technician course, these individuals that complete the emergency medical technician course at the MAC in Valparaiso can enter the fire service or enter the fire academy and then become firefighters, because most fire departments in the area require that candidates for their fire service have to be EMTs as well as firefighters before they even look at them as far as applicants.
When the MAC Foundation set up the training center over in Valparaiso, had they approached you folks at Franciscan Health and maybe other institutes as well, too, to be able to offer the training that the firefighters would get, of course, for their particular craft, police officers the same as well, or even for the emergency room technicians in the hospitals? Did they just find that this is easier to work something out with the EMS Academy and other organizations to kind of bring things together?
Absolutely. I think that one of the benefits is that if they were to utilize a hospital-based program, which mine is, it then prevents them from having to find somewhere for their students to perform clinicals and whatnot, because using a hospital-based program, the students already have that opportunity.
Do the students that get involved in this program in particular, there's kind of in the introductory phase, aren't they? If they get their EMT certification and they go on to become paramedics, they have, of course, a lot more and more specialized training that they have to go through too, don't they?
Absolutely. The emergency medical technician program is usually around 6 months. It's 161 hours of classroom time plus 8 hours of ambulance time plus 8 hours of emergency department time. What we've done with my academy is we've doubled the clinical time to 16 hours of ambulance and 16 hours of ER, which provides the students more patient contacts and makes them more prepared for field work. Now, once a student enters the paramedic aspect of things, yes, it is more specialized training. It's actually about 1,600 hours total. That includes 900 hours of classroom and about 600 hours of clinical time. And then that class is about 9 months in length. But that occurs Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday during the week, whereas Monday and Thursday is usually when the EMT class is conducted.
Do we find that these are young students, students that have just come out of perhaps high school or the equivalency? They're looking into a future, a career of some type, and maybe they're really, really interested in being involved in ambulance work and the emergency room work.
Yes, absolutely. The majority of the students that we do get are, you know, coming fresh out of high school, which a lot of our older medics are kind of jealous of, to be honest with you, because, you know, they wish that, you know, they would have started that young. But yes, the majority of the students that we get as far as EMT class is concerned, they're either fresh out of high school, or we do have some adult students that are just looking for alternate employment or, you know, some sort of part-time job that they might be able to pursue. Or we also have some older staff members or older class students that, you know, they're caring for an elderly family member, and, you know, they just want that added medical knowledge in order to take care of the family.
Certainly wouldn't be a bad idea to be sure. Now, in Crown Point, in Valparaiso, or where the classes are being offered to be able to get the EMT certification, break down where the locations are and the schedules, too, because some of the students are going to be starting in Crown Point sooner than those that might get involved at the Valparaiso program.
Yeah, so the Crown Point course is conducted on Monday and Thursday evenings from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. With some alternate Wednesdays or Saturdays just to facilitate the student's ability to make up some skills. The Crown Point course starts July 8th and runs until December. The Valparaiso course is also conducted 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Mondays and Thursday evening at the MAC. That course starts September 9th. And runs into January.
I would imagine that probably you all there at the Franciscan Health EMS Academy were very much interested in getting the MAC Foundation involved in this. How long did it have to take to get all of the arrangements made so that these courses could get set up to start in September, you know, compared to just having them there at Franciscan Health Crown Point, which is where you're based there?
You know, actually, it took about a 15-minute conversation with Mr. Barnett over at the MAC to get the ball rolling here. He's a wonderful person to deal with. He's very accommodating. He actually welcomed us with open arms when we first approached this opportunity with him. So really, the 15-minute conversation, and then it probably took about less than 30 days to get the applications and all those other things taken care of with the state.
Well, we've kind of gotten the way started here to tell people about what the Franciscan Health EMS Academy is doing, the classes that they've worked in conjunction with the cooperation of the MAC Foundation in Valparaiso for EMT certification. If anybody listening is interested, if they know of family members or other people that are interested, how can they find out more now?
Well, they can go to our website at franciscanalliance.org. They can look up EMS Academy at Crown Point, or they can simply just call my office at 219-757-6461 and just ask to speak with Rob Dowling. We prefer if students call the office, just because, you know, I'd like to, you know, talk with them. It's more of a more personal approach that we like to provide to the student.
Well, it sounds like an interesting program, certainly one, as you say, that not only would pique people's interest, but also might lead to some new job opportunities for somebody who's finished high school or the equivalency, maybe interested in being a police officer or a firefighter or even, for that matter, paramedic. It's all part of it. In fact, it's important to get the EMT certification to even to be qualified to be able to train for paramedic. Rob, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about this, and we hope that this, in turn, will get a lot of people interested and keep these courses going and this cooperation going with the MAC Foundation in the future. Thank you for joining us today about it.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Rob Dowling is the director of the Franciscan Health EMS Academy, and the Franciscan Health EMS Academy is working in conjunction with the MAC Foundation in Valparaiso to set up a couple tiers of courses that in turn will get students trained and off to get their testing and the emergency medical technician certification that they need. This is Regionally Speaking. Let's find out about a way that Northwest Indiana small business gets some support these days from an organization that's called SCORE. There are chapters all across the state, and one here in Northwest Indiana in particular. And we're talking now with Jim Hubbard. He is the immediate past chapter chair and currently the secretary for SCORE's chapter here in Northwest Indiana. Jim, thanks for joining us here on the program today.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with what SCORE is, talk about the organization in general and how important it has become in Northwest Indiana.
Well, SCORE as an organization's been around since 1964. It's a subset of the Small Business Administration, although we are actually a line item in the congressional budget, believe it or not, one of the best returns on taxpayer investment ever. But anyway, we are the nation's premier, and we're the largest volunteer business mentoring organization. It started back in 1964 with the idea that people that are perhaps getting ready for retirement and are going to be leaving the workforce with all this knowledge could maybe share some of their knowledge with the people that are just coming into the workforce and coming into the business world. And that's really the basis behind it. Get people who have knowledge of business, who like to help other people, and connect them with people who need some of that advice. So that's really where it started, and it's been running for 64 years, and it's an all-volunteer organization. There are 320 chapters in the United States. Mm-hmm. There's probably, I think, at any given time, around 11,000 to 12,000 volunteers putting together 2 million hours of free mentoring service to businesses in the United States. I mean, it's a fabulous organization, really.
Well, it sounds like it's an organization that has, as you say, besides being around for a while and have so many people helping out, that they've found ways to help get business mentors to the people that probably need the help the most. And we're talking about young or beginning small business owners and operators. How long has the operation been supporting Lake and Porter and LaPorte, Newton, Jasper counties?
Well, in those five counties here, this chapter is well over 25 years old. Our oldest volunteer has been with the organization 26 years.
Oh.
He retired sometime during that time. He was a volunteer before that. When you say that, but it's not always young people that are starting businesses. There are many people who, throughout their life, decide, okay, it's time for me to work for myself.
Yeah, I hesitate to call them young people necessarily, but they are young, maybe in being involved in businesses. They may
absolutely
have worked. They may work for a business, but that's different. Yeah,
that's right. They're new to the business world anyway, or at least to being their own operating their own business, and that's probably about half of the work that we do is with people who are looking for information about how do I start my business, what do I need to do to get an EIN number, you know, how to get myself registered, what kind of organizational structure should I have? Should I be a sole proprietorship? Should I be a limited liability corporation? Should I be a S-Corp? All those kinds of technical things. And then we help them put together what their roadmap. And the roadmap for any business should be their formal business plan. And that's another area that we're probably best known for, in helping people put together a business plan and make sure that their business model, what they're going to offer in terms of either products or services, to whom are they going to offer them, how are they going to attract those people, how are they going to let the world know that they're there, all those kinds of things, and then how to run the business successfully are things that we spend a lot of time with. Now, there are also individuals who are in business who are having problems one or more areas of their business, whether it's a use of social media, whether it's other marketing issues or sales issues or cash flow. Again, we have a lot of people with a lot of knowledge that can help them through it. So those are the things that we get involved with, and I think that's how we help small businesses in Northwest Indiana get up and get going, and those that are up and going to continue to be successful.
Well, you mentioned about the fact that there are so many different facets, of course, that run a business of any type, some specialized and many of them in general in nature. Can all of the business mentors that help out in the SCORE organization pretty much cover the gamut of all the needs that maybe either new business owner or somebody who's starting one or having problems, as you say, can take advantage of?
Well, I think all of our mentors are capable of assessing what the person needs,
mm-hmm.
but no, each one of us is not knowledgeable in all areas. We have people that are what we would call subject matter experts, so people that are specialists in use of social media, say, people that are marketing and sales specialists, people that are intellectual property specialists, those that have human resource experience. We have business insurance. We have access to people who are knowledgeable. So all of our mentors are able to make an initial assessment of what a client would be looking for, and then we work amongst ourselves to make sure that the people with the right backgrounds and the right experience are connected with that individual.
We're talking with Jim Hubbard, who is the immediate past chairman and currently the secretary for the Northwest Indiana SCORE chapter. There are 10 chapters in Indiana, by the way. SCORE is the big nationwide premier and the largest volunteer network of business mentors. Jim, when you talk about giving assistance to folks that need the help in a small business setting, can you give us any examples that you can think of over the years that seem to have worked out well, that you've had somebody that's had some questions, a new business owner, somebody maybe that needs a little extra help in a certain area of their business, and they've asked for help from SCORE, and the volunteers have come in and done what they can and help turn things around, so to speak?
Well, yeah, we've done a lot of work with folks that are in the service industry,
mm-hmm.
and so whether it be somebody that is a home improvement contractor or somebody providing a service for folks, one of the things that happens is that those are great. They want to go to work for themselves. They're very good, hardworking folks. They work like crazy. They work from morning to dusk, and then they get to the end of the month or the end of the year, and they go, geez, I didn't make any money.
Uh-huh.
And part of it is associated, they don't understand the cost to provide the services that they're doing. They thought it was simply the hours of their time and the materials that they used in the process. And it's more than that. There's this big area called overhead, which are all the other expenses associated with operating a business, from the rent of the space that you have, to the insurance that you're involved there, to the purchase of your equipment and the depreciation. And when you forget those things, then you're working off of your cash flow for providing services, and when you get to the end of the year, you don't have any money left because you didn't do a good job of understanding your total cost, therefore the pricing wasn't correct. So we've done a lot of work with folks there to help them understand their costs. Then they were better able to serve their clients by, I guess, pricing things better that would, you know, make sure they are around and continue business. So I would say in the service industry, we've done an exceptional job. Helped some retailers, and of course, retail is a tough situation now.
Yeah.
And we've helped people with cash flow understand how you have to manage your cash, what money coming in, money going out, and being how to project that into the future so you don't get caught short. Those would be some examples.
Since you have so many people who have been involved so much in business and in all kinds of business facets, working as mentors with the folks in Northwest Indiana, do you have any other relationships that you have with the business community and chambers of commerce, for example, since there are so many of them here in the region?
Glad you mentioned that. We work very closely with the Indiana Small Business Development Center, which is part of the state of Indiana, and we do similar things, but a little bit different. We can share customers. We also have a relationship with most of the chambers of commerce in Northwest Indiana. There are over 20, and we have had personal contact with 17 of them. We work through their offices. We help them. We do workshops in conjunction with them. We work with their membership who have some needs. We'll often come and talk to the folks right there at the offices of the chambers. So we have a great relationship, and the chambers help promote what we do because it's a service for their members. We also work with bankers in this area who are dealing with small business loans, and they love it when somebody comes with a good idea, but they need a little help with their business plan, and they make the referrals to of the client to contact SCORE, and we help them put their business plan together so they fare a little bit better when the loan review committee meets.
Mm-hmm. If anybody has any questions, if they'd like to find out more about SCORE, and particularly the SCORE chapter here in Northwest Indiana, how can they find out more, Jim?
Well, there's two things to do. One, the national SCORE website is probably the best,
mm-hmm.
and it's just score.org. I mean, it's very simple, and you go to that, and you say, I would like to find a mentor, and you click on that. It asks you to put in your zip code. You put in the zip code. If you're in the five counties, it comes directly to us. So then we review that, and we assign it to the right person. And that's probably the premier, and there's information about SCORE, what they do, where the information is. It is one of the best websites for free information any business person is ever going to find. You go to score.org, go to publications and library, and there is a plethora of information on all topics from business finances to loans to marketing and sales to manufacturing to inventory management, all available free. And by the way, that is something about SCORE. We provide all of our services and work with all clients for no cost. I mean, we're all volunteers. We do it because we like to do it.
Well, Jim, thank you much for the information, and the best of luck to the SCORE organization here in Northwest Indiana and the help that they offer through their volunteer mentors and helping businesses in all phases of their particular business. If they have questions, we appreciate you talking about it today.
Okay, well, it's great, and we're available anytime. Been around for 64 years and expect to be around for more.
That's great to hear. Jim Hubbard is the immediate chapter chairman and currently the secretary for SCORE, which is the nation's premier and largest volunteer network of business mentors. Track season is winding down for athletes all across the country, including Indiana and the teams that are involved in the Unified Track and Field. Unified Sports are a collaboration between the IHSAA and Special Olympics. Track is in its sixth season as a unified competition here in Indiana. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart reports that as the sport grows, so does its challenges.
Unified sports are played in many states. Besides track, there's bowling, bocce ball, and flag football in Indiana. Other states play other sports too. The teams are made up of student athletes, kids with intellectual disabilities, and student partners, those without intellectual disabilities. They compete in the same way, together, on one team. Jeff Moeller, the president of Special Olympics Indiana, was at the regional competition in Kokomo last weekend. He says the vision of unified sports is the relationships it fosters.
Why are we here today? Honestly, it's not really to do a track meet. It's really to give opportunities so that people who normally wouldn't be associated with each other, who wouldn't normally interact with each other, they're given a reason to do so.
But they're also there for a track meet. The IHSAA regulates unified track the same way it does any other high school sport, and the rules clearly state that the point is competition, not just participation.
Fans, this is the first flight of the 100-meter dash.
Unified is different than regular track in a few key ways. It's co-ed, there are only five events, three running and two field, and it's a team sport. Lee Lonzo is the liaison between the IHSAA and Special Olympics Indiana.
Regular track for boys and girls is an individual event. So if I'm the fastest in the state in my event, I'm going to go all the way to state and I'll be the state champion.
Part of why Unified is a team sport is so all schools can compete no matter how big their teams are. Jeff Moeller.
We wanted to make sure that a small school, Bremen, small school, could compete against Carmel, the largest high school in the state. Both of them were original members of Unified Track and Field. And so when you do that, you have to limit the entries per event. Or else if you allow unlimited entries, then we may as well just give the trophy right now before the season even starts to Carmel, because they're going to put more kids on the track than anybody else.
At the sectional, regional, and state levels, coaches can only enter four students in each event, two student athletes and two student partners. The students are broken into flights by previous performance. So a kid that's run 12-second 100-meter dashes all season is going to be in a flight with students who have run similar times. Same with a student who runs a 25-second 100-meter dash. Each flight has the chance to earn the same amount of points. So if that faster runner wins their flight, they earn 10 points for their team. And so will the slower runner that wins their flight.
So we have some of the same challenges that every varsity sport has, whether it's football or basketball or baseball or whatever.
Patrick Schooley is the dean at Fishers High School and the head coach for Unified Track, and his son is on the team.
Everyone has a challenge when they get down to tournament time, to sectionals, what they do with their roster. And they have to make tough choices.
As the sport grows, the choices get tougher. The first year of Unified Track and Field, there were 13 teams in the entire state. This year, there were more than 100, and 90 schools competed at the sectional level. Schooley's team at Fishers went from 9 kids the first year to 78 kids this year. With more athletes, it means more of those tough choices.
It's hard to leave any kid. It's hard to leave great kids off of a sectional roster or a regional roster. But we always preach, hey, this is a team sport, and we're going to do what we can do to advance, because we owe that to everybody that's involved, to do everything we can to advance as a team.
Schooley says they try to give students more chances to compete at regular season track meets where there's no four-entry limit, and they try to communicate well with parents so they understand how the competition works. Mulder says with more teams and athletes, the sport will continue to evolve, but at the meets, the friendships and empathy bred in the sport are clear.
You're not looking for that person's an athlete, that person's a partner. What you're doing is saying, oh, there's Warren Central, oh, there's Lawrence North, oh, there's Elkhart Memorial. And that's the beautiful thing about what's happening today, is kind of labels don't matter anymore other than your team name.
Moving forward, the sport may need to add additional events or continue to expand the sectional and regional contests so more students get the chance to participate and compete. The top six teams from both regionals move on to the state competition on Saturday at Indiana University. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
And with another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are two artists of various disciplines. Elise Carmani, who is a filmmaker and composer and a sound magician doing things that I don't know about, and Mally Hoppe, who is a choreographer for something that I was unaware of until today called Michigan City Moves. And Michigan City Moves is a performance-based arts activity that started back in April in four parts. So the first half was in April. The second half is coming up later on in June. So, ladies, first, what is Michigan City Moves?
Michigan City Moves is an artist collective dedicated to experimental performance, workshops, and classes. And we focus on dance, music, film, and integrate those art forms together into performances.
Mm-hmm. And how did it get started? What was the spark?
Well, yeah, I think we collectively are interested in bringing performance to this area. We feel that the visual arts is strong and music is strong and even film. But what we do together is more performance art, and it's experimental and it's kind of pushing the edges. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to bring that to this community. I've spent, you know, many years in New York and Los Angeles. This is my first year anniversary of moving from Los Angeles. And meeting Mally and Christina, we all have the similar aesthetics and similar goals. So we wanted to put something together. And this was Christina's idea, the name of Michigan City Moves.
Mm-hmm.
And Christina Isabel is also our collaborator, and she comes to Michigan City from Columbus, Ohio, but has been in Chicago for the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then she also recently moved to Michigan City. So there was this interesting, you know, collaboration that happened, that the three of us are all coming together at this time, that, and we have very similar interests.
How did you happen to meet?
I was actually introduced to Christina by my sister-in-law because I did site-specific performance in Indianapolis for many years. And my sister-in-law said, hey, there's somebody in Michigan City who's doing site-specific performance. You should meet. And so we met a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then I knew Elise was moving to Michigan City as well. And I said, check out the work of Christina Isabel, you might be interested. Mm-hmm. And so the three of us had coffee and we started brainstorming what we could do here. We all want to be able to work here.
Mm-hmm.
And as a group, I think we have more power than us as individuals doing these larger scale, you know, performances.
Well, I think what you're doing is quite unique for our area. And because you're right, the more traditional art forms have been prevalent for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Your version of performance art is something you're kind of doing it on your own. I think that's great. And so maybe you'll start a trend where this kind of this kind of performance art will be more prevalent as the visual and other performing arts are.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. So tell us about your current series.
Our current series is called Sand, a Migrating Performance, and it's actually inspired loosely on the book Sacred Sands, which was written by John J. Ronald Engel, about the history of the fight to save the dunes, basically. And so that's what we decided to kind of tie the pieces together because we were invited to perform at Portage Lakefront at Lebesnik Center. Christina is involved with Tryon Farm. We knew we had these different performances, and we decided we wanted to have a theme. And that's the theme is based on that sacred sand. So we did one performance already at Portage Lakefront and Riverwalk. And then we did one last week at or in May at Lebesnik Center for the Arts. And then we'll have a third one back at Portage again.
We'll have to have you back.
Okay.
Yeah, for future activities and to keep up with your progress. Michigan City Moves is a website that people could visit.
You have to go through my my company, Mishina.org/MCM. That's a little difficult.
Complicated.
But yeah, you could probably Google us.
And we're on Facebook.
Okay.
Yes, Michigan City Moves. I don't know whether we're so new. I'm not sure whether Google knows us or not.
Well, more later then.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being here and thank you for listening. Okay. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online right now on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And you can join us again next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation right here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. NeighborWorks America is a national organization that tries to create opportunities for people to make the shift from being renters to being homeowners, and a new survey is out that shows how big the gap is between those two. You might be interested in finding out more. That'll be on tomorrow's program. Hope you can join us.